Welcome to the Appen Appen Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And strangely, I'm not Jerry.
And here we are, we're back again after our episode that I didn't attend down at the Og Camp. But we'll come back to that later. So we're on 58. So 58 is in the periodic table. We're up to the lanthanides now of the cerium. 58 is also 3A in hexadecimal. And if anyone's ever followed MotoGP, 58 was the number of a motorcyclist who died in Malaysia called Marco Cimoncelli. If you want to dial Venezuela, then that's the number for you. And also, if you ever watched SpongeBob SquarePants, Patrick claims that 58 is the luckiest number ever. So maybe this will be the luckiest show ever. Who knows? And also, if you look on the number file YouTube video, there's a specific video about the number 58. But we'll leave you to go and have a look for it. And it's also this episode, and we're back from Og Camp. So how's everyone getting on?
Yeah, we're all getting on quite well. We had a good time. Really had fun. And how are you doing, John, from coming back, recovering from Og Camp?
Recovery was pretty brutal, I have to be honest. I had sort of four days of what felt like non-stop action. Not only was I organising the event, but also travelling for sort of two almost full days of it. So yes, it was good fun, but it was very tiring.
Yeah, and we released a podcast from it. I think we got some good feedback and some more listeners from. So yeah, we'll just give a couple of shout outs to for people we met. We met someone called Gary, who's actually lives about 10 miles away from where I actually live, so that's quite spooky. And then we met two other Andrews who are listeners. Well, one of them was already a listener, and then we've got another Andrew who works with proxies and load balancers. So hello to them. Is it Richard Brown from SUSE?
That's correct.
He wasn't available, but he would have been on the podcast at the last week, but he had to fly back. But he's actually followed us. So hello, Richard, if you're listening. So yeah, it was a really good time, and we met loads of people, and hopefully got some more listeners. So that was good, really. So really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so it was a really good time, it was really a privilege for me to be able to record with you guys. With you and Martin as an unscheduled co-host. So thank you very much.
Yeah. I didn't really get time to answer my question, but I think it'd be for another podcast when I reply to it. But I was thinking about on the way home and actually speaking to people that I don't think Microsoft are going to go away too soon yet, because I think it's just a lot of the companies are just still out there using the software. And I mean, a couple of companies we work for, like a water utility company, they're just so ingrained in the software they're using, and it just works. And I just can't, and to change anything, it's hard enough trying to get them to actually spend money on something else. So they're using Windows and it works. It kind of works. I mean, there's people with like the desktop OS as well, and how with Office 365 and Office, I just think I think they're in there for a little while. Yeah, I definitely think with new startups and things, but with people going to a lot of online services, I think they're not really worried what the back end is. And I think that's where it's going to come a stick, where people need to be, whereas all this infrastructure as a code, it seems to be a lot better. I think it's going to be, that's where Linux is going to win, kind of thing.
Yeah, so my experience of the sort of smaller end of the world. I used to do on-site tech support, and this was 10, 12 years ago, and the exchange server at the firm that I worked for blew up, and I went in and replaced it with an IMAP server running sort of various groupware applications to sort of try and give them a tide me over until we could figure out what had happened to this exchange server. Everyone that I was working with there was kind of bemoaning the fact that, you know, they couldn't share calendars and stuff like that. And, you know, those are the sorts of features that, as much as I'd love to say that, you know, a sort of day one rollout of a groupware suite under Linux works with, unless you know which one it is you're looking for, you're really going to struggle to get something like that. And that's really where, you know, the integration between the Office products is really kind of the winning point for me for the Microsoft world. And also, you know, for an enterprise environment, Active Directory is a really big thing to fight against. You know, if you someone the size of Google, who can invest in having, you know, your own authentication system, your own document suite, and those sorts of things, you know, you can take that on. And certainly a lot of the firms that I see that aren't going with, you know, the Microsoft range of tools are going with something like Google's, you know, G Suite, I think it is, they call it now. So you get like the, you know, the
drive or whatever the word.
Yeah. Drive, Docs, Sheets, Gmail. You've got, authenticator tokens like the YubiKey or something for signing in, which, you know, gives you your two-factor authentication. You get two-factor authentication, which you don't, you have to bolt on to Windows. You get your Google laptops, Chromebooks, or the Chrome sticks, or the Chrome whatever the other thing is that you get. You know, it's all tied into Android, and these things all kind of fit together. Whereas, you know, again, you can do the same thing with Windows, but they're not quite cloud native, if that makes sense.
And I definitely think AD is the kind of a thing to go through. It's just so powerful. I mean, especially with locking down the desktops and things with Microsoft, I just can't see there's nothing really can compare with that at the moment. I mean, I guess there's open source versions, but it's just the way it's a lot of investment in companies. Wherever I go is like with between or like 10 and 1,000 users, is they're using it and it just works, kind of thing. So
yeah, so I mean, you can bolt together a solution using Samba, which as of version Samba 4, I think it is Samba 4, can act as an Active Directory domain controller. You can do group policy through it. You can do sort of network login shares and things like that. And then, you know, you can kind of have that enforcement of the endpoint. But what I'm seeing more and more is kind of, rather than following that model, companies that aren't doing Active Directory are following a Google model called Zero Trust Networks, which is where you don't trust the network or the device, but you do. So you don't trust the network, you don't trust the transport. What you trust is the device, because it's been provisioned properly. It's been, you know, blessed by the IT department of the firm you work for, and you know, deployed as appropriate. You know, it's got special tokens and SSL keys and all those sorts of fun things in. So you can kind of enforce your policy through that. But anyway, I'm waffling on a bit.
And is that like a bring your own device kind of thing? Or is it just kind of...
Not really. It's more like... So basically what Google do is while they may have corporate networks... So, like, for example, the firm that I work for, you have to be on specific parts of the network to get the right IP addresses to get into their customer estates. And the way that Google works is that every endpoint is treated as, so even the corporate IT networks in Google are effectively public Wi-Fi networks. And as soon as you attach to that, you VPN authenticate, or you come down a SSL tunnel or something like that with the right client certificates and all those sorts of fun things. And that gets you into the customer's network, into your network, to be able to access, you know, to be able to log into all the elements of that customer's, you know, or that of that environment, you know, the web servers, the application gateways, databases, and all those sorts of fun things. And under the hood, they're all kind of using things like the YubiKey tokens and things like that. And these are sorts of parts of the things why Google's invested so heavily into sort of the two-factor authentication stuff, is because their whole infrastructure relies on those two-factor authentication bits being there and working in a sensible and usable way.
Cool. And what do you think, Andy, about the whole Linux taking over? Oh, well, what happened with the question I've kind of got asked at the old camp about, I can't remember what the exact question was, about are we worried that Linux is going to kind of overtake, or we're out of a job kind of thing if we don't keep up?
Yeah, it was something along the lines of, with the growth of the server side of Linux, are we as Windows admins making ourselves irrelevant? I think it was something along those lines.
Yeah, it does seem to be that, because it's definitely about the server side, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, I can only go from my experience in that, because I'm coming from it from a much smaller sort of point of view. And a lot of the companies that I deal with are a much smaller kind of company, and what the back end is really irrelevant to them. They really don't care. But all I can say is that every single one of my customers, every single company that I work for and do jobs for, none of them have got a clue what Linux even is. You know, they don't want to know what it is. They don't understand what it does. If you say the word Windows to them, you know, that's a comfortable name to hear. You know, they know what it is. They've heard it for years on end. Saying to them, you know, even along the lines of, oh, we can scrap all your Windows computers and give you Linux computers instead, they wouldn't like that, because it's too much into the owner. I mean, for God's sake, I mean, they all moan when you went from Windows 7 to Windows 10. You know, that was such a big, massive change to them. You know, to go on to something completely different is too alien to them.
And yet, ironically, what you probably find is, if you went from, say, for example, someone that was running XP, you know, even, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, and said to them, here's an Ubuntu Mate install, or, you know, here's a KDE install, if you themed it right, they'd never notice the difference, you know.
Yeah.
They'd open up their Office suite and it would look like Office, and it does like Office, you know. Yeah. They'd open up their web browser and it would go to Google or Bing or whoever it is they use, you know.
That's it. Once you get past that, and especially once you're on, because I've taken like my laptop to a couple of places, which has got, you know, Ubuntu on it, and they look at it and they say, "Oh, what on earth's that?" You know. You know, immediately they think it's some new version of Windows that I've got and nobody else has, you know, because I've got a secret code to get a new Windows from somewhere. And you say, no, it's not Windows at all, it's Linux, you see. And they go, oh, God, okay. And, you know, and they just, the initial thing is they don't like it and they don't understand it. But you're right, as soon as you open a Google Chrome browser and you're on the internet, it's all the same.
You know?
Anyone can operate. If you give someone a computer already with Chrome open, one's got Windows on and one's got Ubuntu on. As long as Chrome's open, nearly everyone could operate it quite happily and do everything that they want to do. So I did think at one point that because of like Windows license fees and things like that, you know, and how much a license is for Windows, you know, I don't know, 50, 70 quid or whatever it is, or even with the possibility of them going to Windows subscription, you know, in the future. Just like Office has gone to subscription, you know, Windows may go subscription. That having a operating system which is free could attract people as well. But only if it looked and felt like Windows, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And a lot of them do, because a lot of the, you know, you see a lot, and I've tried a few myself and that, and they do have that start button menu, you know, and they all use Windows, don't they? I don't mean the Microsoft Windows, but they use a window, you know, to display
the windowing paradigm, yeah.
Yeah. So, in one sense, it could be a big hit because it's free. And in another sense, it's too scary because you don't understand what it is. But as I say, most people that I know, all customers, don't even know what it is. You know, and I understand that there's a lot of things that are all Linux driven back end without them even knowing it. I don't know if things like Skyboxes, are they kind of Linux driven?
Skybox? Things?
A Skybox or a Virgin Media box or something like that. Are they Linux driven at the back or?
Typically BSD. Well, yeah, it'll either be Linux or BSD typically.
Yeah. Even things like, you know, like NAS drives, you know.
The thing
they
that
have
got
them in the back end. And
the one that got me was I got a, again, sort of 10-ish years ago, I bought an internet radio, like a big physical radio, yeah. And opened the box, and there's a sort of copy of the GPL license kind of wrapped around the top. You know, when you open this box, you adhere to this license. And it's like, oh, this must be running Linux of some description under the hood. And actually, yep, if you dug into it, yes, it was running a Linux derivative sort of in this, you know, sort of 30 quid rate or 50 quid radio. So,
crazy. If you look at the other thing, you know, if people's, if you mention the word Mac to people, then people have heard of that, you know, and they've heard of the name, they're comfortable with the name, they know that they're generally a lot more expensive than Windows computers, but they're comfortable with the name, you know.
Mm.
But a lot of people are scared to go over to Macs because A, they cost a lot, and B, they're all different, you know.
Yeah.
And this is coming at it from a point of view of people who don't understand computers one bit. They just switch it on and use it, you know. And so I can understand on the back end, the hidden end, the server end, you know, that could possibly, nothing anytime soon, though. I must say, you know, it's not like a couple of years down the line, but it might be. But who knows what a change in years to come. But certainly on the home consumer-based sort of side of it, you know, at this point in time, no one knows what Linux is, you know.
Mm.
I think, but it is run a lot, you know, because I know there's things like that. You know, it's probably like, you know, these Wi-Fi kettles, you know, that you can get, and you know, you can connect your kettle up to the Wi-Fi and, you know, get it to boil when you're on your way home, you know. That's probably driven by that in some form or other. So, yeah. It's quite common, you know, in people's lives, isn't it? Really, they just don't know it.
Another thing as well, like if you've got something like a person who's running Office or whatever, and they know how to use it, and then you give them LibreOffice, I think it's just such a, it doesn't look as nice and clean as what an Office, kind of like an Office 2016. I think as well. I think it's better.
Yeah, it's very different.
I think it's also like. Go ahead, Andy.
Sorry, yeah. I think Office, Open Office, LibreOffice looks like Office 95. You know, I think because it doesn't have the ribbon along the top that people are used to now and all that kind of stuff, it looks like a very old version of Office and Word and things like that. It does its job, you know. But yeah, you have the same problem with that, yeah.
I mean, I think the Open Office or LibreOffice outside of work because that's just what I want. But it just takes a bit of getting used to. But I just don't think that if you brought it to a company or whatever, I think it's definitely going with the CTO of the company. If they're in it, if they're Windows based, then that's all they're going to do. That's all they want to do, isn't it? I think if it's the same as my thing. But why brought that question up last week is that my boss went, "Why, who's going to support Linux at 4 o'clock in the morning?" I think it's just a people's mindset, and that's kind of why I wanted to kind of get more into Linux, because I think one day it might go that way. And but it seems to interest me more that the whole kind of Linuxy thing and doing infrastructure as a code and everything.
So I think the thing that would have had the potential to give people more of a swing across to sort of the Linux world would have been if the Ubuntu phones had taken off, because you know you had a third option on the market, and if people had taken an interest in that, then they'd have been saying, the Android phones are the Google sort of, they tie in with the Google products, the Chromebooks, all those sorts of things. You know, you've got the Windows phones, which tie in with the Microsoft world. You've got the iOS iPhones that tie in with the Apple world. And then you've got this Ubuntu phone that potentially, you know, could have driven people to Linux. Obviously, that kind of all collapsed, sadly. But, you know, that product line could have driven people towards Linux, and I think that would have made a big difference.
What's the right word for this? The heritage, I suppose, or the origins of the different operating system, because isn't Mac that traced back to Linux in some way, or through Unix or something like
that?
Yeah.
So
is there a family tree, if you like, but they've got a common ancestry?
Sort of. The AT&T Labs, which were previously called Bell Labs, I think, created what we now refer to as Unix, and they sold some parts of that to Novell. But at the same time as Novell was sort of buying parts of that, there's a group of students and staff at the Berkeley University in the States who developed BSD, the Berkeley Software Distribution. And so the BSD distribution, Apple used elements of that in the Mac OS X line or OS X line. They replaced the kernel with their own kernel called Darwin. But yes, on the whole, it's based on the BSD line. Linux is not a Unix derivative. It's designed to work in the same way that the Unix kernels work. It's not a Unix derivative. And in fact, actually, the GNU, in the set of GNU userland tools, is actually a recursive acronym for GNUs, not Unix. So on top of that as well, the Unix word is actually a trademark, and to become a Unix derivative, or even a Unix compliant operating system, required a lot of money that at the beginning of the project was seen as not being necessary. And later on in the project, they it was almost like a matter of pride that it wasn't Unix, so there you go.
Okay. Yeah, because I just remembered there's some similarities in some of the you know, some of the commands and stuff, you know, like sudo and things like that. Because I've used that in Mac and I've used it in Linux as well. But yeah, I just thought there was something like that, because there has been loads over the years, hasn't there, that I keep remembering about as something comes up, you know, things like yeah, Novell as well. Was that one you've just mentioned?
Yeah, so Novell, Novell bought the Unix, the Unix trademarks. There's a really good website about kind of all the origins of the Linux and sort of Unix back and forth. Actually came out of the back of when, I can't remember which, who it was now that was taking them to court, but a company that had bought some parts of the Unix code took several customers of, I think it was Red Hat's, to court because they had bought a Linux software release, and that was Unix code, and they'd not paid their Unix licenses. And that website's actually called Groklaw, which is, it closed down at the end of the case, well, a few years after the end of the case, but it still sort of tracks. There's, I believe there's still all the documentation about kind of the heritage of the various Unix distributions and Linux distributions, and kind of who took code from where and where it all tied together. And it was a brilliant resource used by pretty much every participant in that court case, to sort of show where things were and weren't sort of part of this particular case. It's a brilliant, brilliant website for it.
Okay, great. I'll have to put a note in that, in the show notes.
So yep. Coming back from going back to the talk, I was kind of thinking, like, because Martin was saying, oh, you can get support from either Ubuntu, as in, like, so you, if you have a problem, you've got, you can phone some up. So I kind of was quite interested in that. So I kind of did a bit of research to kind of compare it. So I basically got the three main distributions where I could work out which you can pay for support. And I think, so I've got Red Hat, Ubuntu, and SUSE. I think that they were the main three ones. Is that, would you say, John?
Yeah, I'd say so.
So what you pay for is, with Red Hat, it's you get your updates and you get support. Ubuntu, you kind of get just the support out of it. And then you get SUSE, I think, again, is that you get the updates and the support. So I kind of, so I've done it in two ways. So if you've got a physical host and or you want one instance of supporting one of these VMs or one of these distributions, so Red Hat for that is per year is £1,000. Ubuntu, which they call their Advantage for servers, for a single physical host is £1,100, and SUSE is £930 a year, which I didn't think
per host, sorry,
which is not too bad.
Is that per host?
Per host.
Right.
So okay. That's if you've got this is where it gets a bit complicated. So if you've got them as that's a single host for everything. So if you've got a Red Hat, so let's say you've got, like, in the Windows world, so, or if you're running a VMware environment, or and you've got a physical host, which has got loads of memory in it and loads of CPU, you can run multiple copies of it. So if you're running Red Hat or SUSE, and you're running something like VMware or under it, or their own virtualization like KVM or something, you can buy a product which is Red Hat is just over £3,000 per year, so you can run unlimited VMs. And SUSE does the same thing, where you can run as many VMs as you want on one host, and that is £1,800. I don't know if this is Ubuntu shooting yourself in the foot hair or anything, but Ubuntu don't seem to do a a high density kind of virtual machines. With that price, as I said a minute ago, just over £1,100 for that advantage, if you run their KVM solution, you could have as many hosts, as many VMs as you like. So you can run many instances of Ubuntu you like. But they don't support, looking at the terms and conditions, they don't support anything like a VMware hypervisor or Hyper-V kind of thing. But they do this thing where you can buy guest packs. So if you've got 10, if you run 10 virtual machines, that costs £2,400. So if you're in the cloud or whatever, and you've got 10 VMs or whatever, instances in Azure or whatever, or AWS, that costs, yeah, that's $2,500 kind of thing. So compare that to Windows, whereas like if you buy a standard edition, which is for a physical host, and you get two instances of Windows up to 16 cores, because that goes in the place in the minute, it's £628, and you buy that, and then that's yours forever. But obviously you don't get any support with that. You get updates or whatever for the life of the product, but you don't obviously get support. Obviously, if you have to buy a support contract, or you go to an MSP like me, or if you have an instance where you have to phone up my call, it's about £250, I think, you can phone up for get emergency support. And then for the data center, so that's like if you've got a single host, as long as it's got less than 16 cores, you can have as many virtual Windows VMs as you want, and that's £5,500 kind of thing. So that's where they make their money. And obviously now, it's very hard to get, and that's 16 cores if you've got over two processors, but it's not very often you can get the processors these days with less than 8 cores in it. So if you go over 16, you have to then start buying extra core licenses. So
interesting. So I was just having a quick look there as you were talking at the Microsoft pricing model. And it's really, really hard to find Microsoft pricing.
You won't find any pricing on their website or anything, because it has to go through reseller.
So just as a rough kind of finger in the air figure, I found a random ZDNet article that mentions the Windows 10 Enterprise subscription of £84 per year, and then the Server 2016 standard device with a per core model of $882. Now, I'm not entirely sure what that entails, and certainly if I'd have thought about it, I should probably have actually had a bit more of a dig around on that one. But you know, if you're looking at a desktop model of like 80, let's say 100 quid a year per desktop, and about, let's say, about £1,000 per server, you know, the pricing model isn't that dissimilar from the sort of arrangement that you'd have with a SUSE or a Linux or a Canonical or someone like that. Interestingly, though, I don't know whether you've ever actually tried to engage Microsoft support, but certainly where I the unless you've got a partner arrangement with a Microsoft, you can't pick up the phone and phone someone. And even if you have got a partner relationship with Microsoft, basically, if you pick up the phone and ask a question, and it's a question you could have found the answer to by looking through their documentation, they charge you a huge amount of money on top of whatever you would have been paying them as well. So we're always kind of heavily dissuaded from contacting Microsoft, and you always have to go through, you know, the partnership group first, who then, it's their job to pass all of the documentation to make sure that the question you're about to ask is not a stupid question.
Yeah, because I mean, with us, we get critical support because obviously we're a gold partner with Microsoft, and you have to pay a bit of money to get that kind of thing. Yeah, we get unlimited critical calls, so we ever only really speak to Microsoft unless it's like a problem where, like, it's, yeah, which you can't fix yourself, and it's like, and every time I've played it, they are quite good, but they are very, when you speak to them, it's like, right, they define what that issue is, so before they start looking, they like say, right, what's your problem? And then they say, right, this is the only thing we're looking at. We're not looking at anything else. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And they say, yeah, and you can get that if you pay, I think it's about £250. Because when I was looking for another company, they didn't have that, but it's quite hard to find it. But you couldn't like phone them up and say, oh, I want to do this or this. You just have to need to know where to go, kind of thing. So.
But yeah, so I think the relationship with the Suses and the Red Hats and the Canonicals of this world does seem to be that, you know, it's a lot more like a true partnership with the open source companies. Whereas with Microsoft, it's very much a case of you are literally paying for the fact that here's the software, you know, and then, like you said, you can uplift that to a better relationship, but it's certainly fundamentally at its core, open source seems to be a lot more about community and being a part of that community together. And you know, the Microsofts and even to a certain extent the Apples of this world, it's a lot more about, you know, you bought our product, brilliant, fantastic, thanks very much. You know, if you've got a problem, you're paying for it.
Yeah. And I think that's where we make my money. That's what I get paid for, really, isn't it? Doing that kind of
Yeah.
and that's why a lot of people make a lot of money. I mean, listen to another Microsoft podcast. They have like professional engineers. So like if you like your big insurance companies or whatever, then you will be having a contract with Microsoft directly, and you get all those that support. And that's where we make our money, is by doing all the support and understanding their application. And I think as well, if I did Linux stuff, I'd probably know it more inside out. Like Martin was saying that he did that, he was looking after all those data centers, and he was the one who set it all up. But I'm guessing it's because you know it inside out, don't you? That's what it is. And then I know my products inside out, what I know. And it's not, very rarely we have to phone up Microsoft to say, yeah, we need some help, kind of thing. It's only when it really the shit hits the fan, we have to give them a ring, kind of thing, because it's quicker for deal with them because that's their product. I mean, the only time I really phone them up is when it really is at the fan, like Exchange Server's fallen over or something, and we need to get it back up again, or Cluster's fallen over, because they are the people who know how to fix it, kind of thing. So.
Yeah. No, I understand that. I understand that.
But have you ever spoken to anyone support wise at Conical or Suse or anything? Have you ever had to deal with them before?
No. But I did reach out to one of my colleagues that was in so again at the company I work for, as I said, we've got that group that has that owns the relationship between our company and Microsoft. So everything goes through them to make sure you're not raising erroneous calls and all those sorts of fun things. But the same team actually does support the open source relationships as well. And I asked him sort of how it works, and basically what he said was that they're pretty flexible as long as you don't take advantage of the conversation. So whereas before you said, you know, when you phone up Microsoft, they literally banned the conversation to, you know, say for example you had a blue screen of death, they'll ban it specifically to that blue screen of death, without, and they won't discuss anything else. Whereas, you know, the other vendors will. They'll go through a script to find the issue, but then you'll get extra debug, and they'll you know, until they find that, you know, you've installed some third party package, or, you know, it's something that's not specifically down to them, you know, they'll work with you to kind of get to the end of that. And again, it kind of proves kind of the different structures of the firms behind it. You know, like I said, it's all about community on the open source side, and it's all about the product on the Microsoft side, or at least that's how it feels to me. Yeah, I might be wrong.
Yeah, but also I think as well is that I'm guessing if you're running, you were running like a SAP server, and you wanted on SUSE, so you definitely want to buy the SUSE support kind of thing. But I was thinking where like the world of Jerry, where he's doing a load of DevOps or whatever, I can't see them buying support from Ubuntu to run their web apps, I'm guessing, because I'm guessing if it works, if it doesn't work, tear it down and rebuild it again kind of thing.
Sort of. I mean, I guess if you're in the sort of situation where, you know, you've got a massive memory leak in something and it's you know, you've got a box that stood up for, you know, half an hour and then it's out of resources, then absolutely at that point you would engage a Red Hat or a Canonical or someone like that. And in fact, actually, with CentOS being kind of the open source server orientated version of Red Hat that is not a purchased product, about 2 or 3 years ago CentOS was actually bought out by Red Hat, so that if you've deployed CentOS because it was free, but, you know, a year or 6 months down the line you discover that an application you've built on that CentOS platform is failing you for whatever reason, you can actually then engage Red Hat support, who will get you to install a handful of packages from the Red Hat site, and it turns your CentOS box into a Red Hat box, which then means it's under support with Red Hat. And you can purchase the support through them at that point. So, yeah, it's... I can see why people wouldn't purchase the support, and certainly environments that I've built, how I've built with Linux distributions, because you know that you're not paying a per seat license for that, you're not paying a per core charge for that license.
Yeah, and the other thing as well, equally, with the Windows stuff, you obviously have to buy for a CAL as well. If you've got a Windows server and you're not running it in Azure, you have to obviously buy a CAL kind of thing. So
yeah.
So
Andy, if you went into one of your customers and said to them, you know, we could replace your back-end file server with this box that's not going to cost you any money, you know, do you think any of them would take you up on that? Or would it be, you know, it's running Microsoft and that's the only way we're going to play it?
If it was back-end, you know, such as a... what you mean, like a NAS drive or something, or along those?
Yeah, like a file server, or a print server, or even an authentication system or a proxy or something like that. You know, would you be able to deploy something like that for one of your customers?
Well, it wouldn't be something I'd build and make myself, but buy ready made, yeah. Although I have made a little Ubuntu server, which is still running now, actually, which is quite good. But in terms of them, knowing what's on it, you see, say it was a little NAS drive. Remember when Al remembers this, and I made this little NAS drive, which was just the Ubuntu server, just using it as a file storage location, basically. And you plug it in, you set it up, I'd set it up, and then, see, they wouldn't know that it was what it was running or how it run, because they would access it through Windows, you know, they'd go to my computer, S drive, M drive, or whatever you map it as, and drop the stuff there. So as far as they're concerned, it's still a Windows thing.
Yeah,
because they're using Windows on their local machine to save it to S drive or M drive or whatever they call it. what's happening. They don't know it's a Ubuntu server at the other end, for example. So that wouldn't concern them one bit, as long as, you know, because the usability of it is, you know, is easy, isn't it? You know, save it to S drive.
Mm.
You know, and I could say, well, it, you know, that box, that NAS drive backs up every night onto a, either remotely or onto a little USB hard drive or something, or whatever they have, that backs up every night. As long as they have support for it, and their support would be me, then they'd be quite happy with that.
And if you, so if you had that kind of product that you'd, you know, if you, let's say for sake of argument, you've decided that you're gonna take a box that is running Ubuntu that you've pre-built, and you're gonna sell that. Would you then buy a support contract with a Canonical or someone like that, or would you only then raise that support contract at the point at which you had a problem?
I wouldn't take it out initially. No, I'd only raise it if there was a problem. And I'd try and do it because it would be small. You see, you know, it's not big enough to have that. And if I was to do something like, you know, set up some kind of backup or whatever, then if it all did go wrong, you know, I know it sounds a little bit crude, but if it did go wrong, I'd rebuild it and copy everything from the backup.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, so
this little box I've made, you know, install Ubuntu server on, set up, you know, a particular directory to be an S drive and whatever. You know, that S drive gets backed up onto a USB. If it all goes wrong, I can reinstall Ubuntu server with my own documentation, you know, so I know, you know, how it was set up to begin with and what I did. Try and make it identical, or even, like, you know, do images of it or whatever. And then do that myself. So it would be too small to do that, because it sounds like it's quite a bit of money anyway.
So taking it from the other direction, if you were to set up a Windows server, obviously you've got to pay for the server licenses for that.
Yeah.
You know, would you put them onto a support, you know, would you have a support contract with Microsoft? Or is it the same sort of situation, only if you had an escalation issue that you needed to bring in?
That would be all down to them, right? Now, a few people I know have got support contracts with particular software vendors themselves, right? One example is this Exact Software in the dental world. Now, they have, it's not a support contract exactly. Well, it is. It's kind of like a subscription license that they pay for all the time. And as part of that license, the system operates. And if they have any troubles, you can phone up and fix them. So any kind of support contract like that, they would do. So yeah, any kind of things like that with Windows, if they wanted a support contract with Windows for a Windows server, then that's something
I would
probably get them to do. But that actually raises something else, you know, because you're talking about this. Is all this support contracts on software side? Because I know, you know, listening to the Mike Tech Show and that, and he uses a lot and supports a lot of Dell servers. So a lot of the support contracts, the clients that he deals with, his clients have contracts with Dell, you know, for the server, either warranty or extended warranty or whatever. You know, and there's been many occasions that he said on his podcast, you know, where if the server fails or something fails in the thing, they phone up Dell. You know, Dell ship out a new power supply or a new motherboard or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the hardware contract that they have with
them. Yeah.
So it's these things you're talking about. I suppose it would be software, really, would they? But do they include hardware as well?
No.
Because what would happen if something physically failed? You know, say it was a Windows server and it was a Dell server and you had a contract with Windows, then Windows wouldn't ship out,
no,
you know, a replacement dual power supply for a server, would they?
No.
Yeah.
And equally, yeah. So equally, you wouldn't expect Dell to be supporting Windows.
No.
So yeah. Which is the only times when.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
I'll say that again.
The only times when I would be in a position where a support contract covers both the software and hardware is when you're talking about embedded appliances. So obviously my day job is working with security products, and they tend to be, supplied by a vendor, and it is everything from, the chips on the board all the way through to the application that's running at the endpoint, and they own the whole stack.
It's a whole package, isn't it? It's not universal.
No, and so we've got products that run, that are based on BSD, based on Windows, based on Linux, the whole suite of it. And ultimately the support contracts that we have is with the product, the appliance vendor, and they then back off their support with the, BSD people or the Red Hat support teams or the Microsoft support teams as is required for their appliance. So
yes.
So when you have these contracts, what do the contracts for? Are they for? So obviously, in all your companies, you have your area of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
right? And then, if you had a support contract from, say, Windows or whatever, I mean, is that literally just for the stuff that you come across that you've never heard of before, or something new comes up and you haven't got a clue what the answer is, or you're completely stuck, or you haven't got time to kind of figure it all out? Is that the kind of time that you'd need that support contract, to say, right, this has gone wrong, the customer's screaming, I haven't got time to figure out what the problem is, because you probably could figure it out, couldn't you, given time? Is it a kind of time related thing, or is it a kind of knowledge related thing, or is it a kind of obviously new things are happening all the time?
It's kind of a combination. So I don't know about Al, but certainly where I am, what typically tends to happen is when a customer is losing money, they start to scream. And at a certain point, the call goes from, this is affecting me, to this is affecting our entire service. And at that point, we get an escalation call happens. And basically, it's a pile-on of so you have representatives of the customer, or for the service delivery teams, you'll have the networks people, the security people, the applications people, literally anyone that's involved in that element of that service gets pulled into that call. And at a certain point, the service delivery team will say, either this is taking too long to solve, or the support people will say, we've done everything we can and we can't fix this now. And at that point, you pull the handle.
Yeah.
And the support team, the barrier between us and the support contract is engaged. They come on the call and they then contact the vendor. And typically it'll be because, you're talking about a kernel panic or, memory utilization that's gone wildly off the charts. Or it'll be something at the OS level, really, that you as a jack of all trades, because we're specialized in the areas that we're there to support for, but as a firm that's got a broad range of skills, like you said, it's a thing that you haven't come across, or it takes too long to fix, or whatever. But typically, what you hit at that point is actually everything stops, because you're then waiting on the vendor to come back to you. And I don't know if that's the same case with you, Al, but certainly that's been my experience.
The way we kind of work is that a couple of things is we're the first line support for the company. And as soon as a call comes in, it gets prioritized. So we have a thing between P1 and P4, so they're priorities. And a P1 is that you're losing money or not losing money, but the systems we're supporting is down. So if it's only affecting a couple of people, it's like a P3. Or if it's something that could be dealt with tomorrow, it's a P4. But if something like it's affecting the whole server is down, that's a P1. And we have a response time within 15 minutes to respond to that. And once we respond in that 15 minutes, then we can then look at what we can do. And then basically just kind of then to start looking, that engineer will then start looking at that for 15 minutes. And then we have to update the customer every like half an hour, 50 minutes to tell them what's happening. And then if it just gets escalated up and up and up the chain of command, and we just kind of, people just get pulled in if it's really kind of thing. And then if it's a hardware fault, Andy, I don't know what it is with Dell, but because obviously we're at HPE, actually a thing called, we do pro partnering. So we actually do the first line support for HPE. So if you phone up HPE, if you've got a server and you phone up, they you'd speak to someone first line and they do the thing, have you checked the firmware, is it up to this level? We don't get that. We get put through to second line support, and we actually hold stock for HPE for our customers. And yeah, we would deal with it for them, if that makes sense. So we get a thing called a care pack, Andy, which is an SLA which HP guarantee. So normally if you buy an HP server straight off the shelf, it gets next business day delivery, next pay NBD, which is next business day support, which means that if a disk goes or a motherboard goes, they will speak to you straight away, but they won't guarantee a part or engineer till the next business day. You can then uplift that to a care pack, which is like they do a thing called a 6-hour call to fix. So as soon as you log a call, they will guarantee someone on site with the part to fix that within 6 hours. What we normally do is, because that's quite expensive, we normally do a 4-hour on site kind of thing. So if they will guarantee somewhere on site with 4 hours with the part kind of thing to fix it. And the good thing about with HP is they will actually, you can actually buy add-ons. So you can actually buy VMware or Microsoft support with that. So they will actually front it. So they have a Windows team or VMware team will actually do the first and second line support, and then they will then uplift it to VMware or Microsoft once, if they can't have an issue. But no, those care packs are really good, and they, customers do normally buy them after if they have a motherboard going, their server's down for a day because they can't get a replacement until the next day. But we always sell everything with a 4-hour care pack. So one thing I was from Odd Camp is that Mark Johnson did a talk on his ripping of audio DVDs, and I asked him what he was writing. He writ the software, and it's actually in Ruby, not Python. So because I know before I was talking about that, I want to learn programming, kind of not just looking at code and trying to hack it all together. I want to actually learn the methods or the, I don't know what you'd call it, behind it. I want to know the strings and things like that. I don't know what you would kind of call that method of programming. I don't know what you would call that.
It's about being fluent in the programming language. So it's fluency rather than anything else.
Yeah, I do want to know, like, I know that you can do if loops and stuff. I wanted to know what, like, a way of understanding it so that I could write programs myself kind of thing. So I found a quite good YouTube series on it, which is from a system administrator, and he was really good. So I'll put that link in the show notes for that. And there's one here for you. He was saying that you should And the Mark saying why I like Ruby because he says it's a really easy language to learn and it flows a lot better and you can program a lot more easier in it. So before you start start using Python kind of thing. So another thing I found is that because of all this like got me thinking last weekend of learning stuff, it always happens like about from comments. I've been kind of playing with Ubuntu server a bit more, I want to get into Ansible and understand how that kind of works. So I've been kind of setting up Ubuntu from scratch and kind of learn it more. And I found the server guide, which I put a link in the show, which is basically like their PDF, which like tells you how you can configure it. It's a really useful guide. So I'll put that in the show notes as well.
So I've done a fair amount of Ansible stuff recently. In fact, I have a blog post that's been sitting in my drafts folder for about 9 months now, called Me and My Lab or something like that, which is the one that I wrote before I left the role that I'm, you know, to join the role that I'm in now. And that's all driven with Ansible. So like Andy, when you were saying before about kind of, you know, your documentation on how you stood up this box, I would absolutely have that as a set of Ansible scripts that says, you know, this is how you provision the users, this is software to install, you know, this is the repositories to put in, this is the user accounts, this is the passwords, you know, these are the IP addresses. That so the whole lot would be an Ansible script. And it means that once you've brought your box up, you just kind of run this one script that you cloned from GitHub or wherever, and it just does the whole shebang for you.
So you'd reinstall the Ubuntu server like standard,
yep,
first, and so you're just up to the basics, and then run that script.
Yeah.
Oh wow. Okay.
So can I ask them, John? So like I've just been playing like. So I literally just set it up and made... I'll probably work about... Because I know that like if you're running in AWS, you can kind of like... you can make your image and then script and then obviously make a clone of it so that when you deploy it, it's got all the... So I was like being... So that it basically makes sure that it had an SSH on it. So I'm guessing you can run Ansible to like say, make sure the system's up to date. And the first thing I do is like to say, is copy my... by public keys to the authorized key kind of thing. And I'm guessing you can do things like setting permissions on folders and stuff, because I'll probably want to do it for my VPS, which runs my my web server. So I'm guessing, would you then in the future, if I had a copy of my Nginx config, I could put that into Ansible and then deploy another instance of my server and then say, make sure that Nginx installed and make sure that this is the config kind of thing. And I'm guessing you can then say, like, make sure this folder's got this permissions on it and create this user and password, I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. So what you can do with Ansible is you can say, these are the, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20, you know, 500, whatever users that you want to have on that box. And like you said, you can say, you know, say for example, it's an Ubuntu box. You'd then have it do apt install, Nginx. You'd then say that here is a template file for, what this config file must look like. And here are the variables to pass into it. So you can say, for example, have, if you wanted each of those users, for example, to have, a specific directory or even you know subdomain in the Nginx config files that they can, you know, have whatever config they want on there, you can absolutely have your template for that Nginx put in there. But the other thing that you said as well was about, you know, when you stand a machine up at the end of that process, you'd copy your SSH keys and things like that on there. And you'd make sure certain things were on that box. On the recording we made last week, I mentioned that I use Vagrant for a lot of things like that. And in fact, actually in the show notes, I built an Ubuntu desktop machine through Vagrant that at the end of the... So it's actually built from an Ubuntu server image. But at the end of the Ubuntu server install, it installs all the packages to turn it from an Ubuntu server to a Kubuntu desktop, plus install the packages that I need to be able to run Ansible and OpenStack commands, and it's got certain volumes mounted in specific locations. It's got user accounts created and SSH keys installed in the right places, all those sorts of things. So I actually stuck that in the show notes in case anyone's interested in that.
In this week's
In this week's show notes, yeah.
Okay, so what's different between Vagrant and Ansible then?
So, Vagrant is a way of standing up... historically, it was a way for developers to have the same environment in their local development for initially for web development, basically, so that the guys that were running Windows machines or Mac machines to develop Linux applications could just Vagrant up a standard build machine, which would be, you know, an equivalent of their production web server and their production database server, and potentially their production load balancer. So you'd have these kind of three machines that you would always stand up. And because of the fact that the Vagrant machine is then pulling from a common source, and it's just effectively a text file, you can commit that to your version control system for your web development team. So your web development team if you were a new hire in this web development team on day one, you'd be told, doesn't matter what your OS is, but install Vagrant, install VirtualBox, and then clone this repository from our GitHub repo and go into this directory, run Vagrant up. And then you've got on your machine, say for example, 3-tier web service, which is consistent across the development for every single person in that team. So it means that there's none of this, you know, well, it works on my machine environment because it's the same environment across all the machines. The difference between that and Ansible is that Vagrant has in it a provisioning service. And that is the point at which you would then invoke an Ansible script or a shell script or a puppet or a chef or a salt sack or whatever. But so your Vagrant gets it to the end of the boot process and then runs a provisioning script. And so if your machine that you provision is, say for example, an Ubuntu server, you can then apply the same Ansible script against your development environment as you would on your production environment. And so you've always got the same set of scripts that run against all the same machines.
Cool. That makes sense. And also, before we... is it an interesting... Maybe I found out what it was, but at home I run a Windows DNS server, which is basically a .local. Mm-hmm. And I have everything kind of pointing to that. And so I set up a couple of some test boxes, and I basically created a static DNS entry in them, so it's something like apps.chrisman.local, and from my Windows box I could ping that, but from my Ubuntu box I couldn't ping it. It wouldn't work, and my DNS servers of my local machine was set to my Windows box. And it had this thing where it could put these are DNS prefixes to check. And if you typed NS lookup, you could type, obviously you connect to your DNS server, you could type apps.chrisman.local and press return, and it came back the IP address. But when you tried to ping it from the command prompt or the telnet or the terminal, it wouldn't return the IP address. Have you come across that before, John?
I know exactly what it is. Well, I've got with about 75% certainty. I know what that is, which is .local is actually a specific DNS suffix, and it's actually used by a thing called MDNS, which is basically instead of sending your DNS requests to a DNS server, you actually send them out on the broadcast IP address of your network. And the MDNS entries are all .local. So if you were to rebuild your Windows box to be not something 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 .local, and instead something 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 .lan or something like that, it would probably resolve it.
And that was what it was.
I can't guarantee it, but I think there's a fair chance that that's what it is.
Yeah. So what I did is I edited a config file in /ns-switch or ns-switch.conf, and there's a file in there. Let's edit it now. Let's go through my history to see what.
Is it mentioning a thing called Avahi? A-V-A-H-I.
And it basically says you have to take out the MDS 4_minimal. So it looks like it, when it's a DNS entry, it checks your file, I'm guessing, first, which is your host file. Then it checks this MDS thing, which you were talking a minute ago. And then it checks your DNS. So yes. All you do is you just edit that file and you remove the MDNS part of it. And so it just checks the file, your host file first, and then it goes.
Yep.
So yeah.
Yep.
So if anyone comes across that, it's been like bugging me for about a year or something. And I was like, right, I'm going to figure this out, why this isn't doing this kind of thing. So
yeah. Unfortunately, it's one unfortunate downside to MDNS is that MDNS. So if you on your Windows box, install, I think it might even be iTunes or something,
yes,
like that.
It is.
That installs the MDNS package as well. So it actually would probably stop your local DNS resolution working, yeah, for that as well.
Cool. Thanks, Fletcher. Any other things? We're probably going for about an hour and a bit now, so we better not go on for too much longer. Keep it for an hour kind of thing. So any last words kind of thing?
Now, I've got some things, but I'll leave until the next show.
Yeah, I think we had quite a good chat tonight, really, about that kind of thing. So, John?
The only thing that I was going to mention is through work, I've been doing a lot of stuff with what they call Kanban boards, which is like a way of doing scheduling your workload. And I found this really useful little script for Outlook, because obviously we have to use Outlook at work. And it's actually a way of doing Kanban with Outlook tasks. And literally all you do is you create 5 folders in Outlook, and then you clone this Git repo, and you point you can change the location of the Outlook Today folder that nobody ever looks at, which is the root part of Outlook. When you go to like the name of your account or whatever it is, that you can change where that points to this web page, and that basically sets up a full Kanban board for your Outlook. So I've stuck the URL to that in the show notes for this week as well, which I think you guys, your listeners may find useful.
Okay, I was asking what that was, because I saw you preached on LinkedIn about that. So what is that other part of the Kan? What is that? I never heard of that before.
So Kanban is a methodology of scheduling your tasks. So basically, you should only ever have 5 things in your work in progress. And even that's kind of like a high limit. So everything else is either backlog. So it's something that you are, you're not doing at the moment, or you have done and you are no longer doing. So you've moved it back into your backlog. You've got work in progress and you've got completed. This particular task board also adds something like up next and focus, I think it was, from memory. as two extra sort of folders to that system. But if you want to have it as a pure Kanban environment, then yeah, you can have it as just those three elements. So that's, as I said, backlog, work in progress, and completed. So,
well, that's quite good, that, yeah. I'll have a play about with that, I think.
Sounds cool. And I think another lesson I want to talk about is Git at some point. I want to learn how that kind of works and how you
what was that?
Commit and stuff like that. It's one of the things I want to, for another day.
So what you really need, and this is the point where I have tried a little bit and failed to channel my inner Jerry, is you actually need to talk to somebody who does DevOps, because DevOps is not all about the continuous integration and version control, but Jerry will definitely be a strong contender for help with you on that one.
Yeah,
I know enough to keep the stuff that I'm doing running, and I have been known when I've made dreadful mistakes in my version control environment to just delete the version control tree that I've got on my machine and then reclone it from source, because it's all gone so horribly wrong.
Talking about Jerry, I wanted to say that from OddCamp we had a lot of stickers made up for laptops, and I've got quite a few left, and I know that Jerry's order is not the greatest, so we've had people comment on it, so I wanted to kind of do a bit of a fund me page or fund me for him to get him a new mic. So if anybody wants any stickers, if they email me directly and at al@abnabandpodcast.co.uk, and I was thinking about saying a minimum of £2, I'll send out some stickers to you, and then we can help Jerry get a new mic. So
and what if somebody just wants to help Jerry get a new mic, and they don't want the expense of sending you sending them stickers? Would you accept just charitable donations like that as well?
I think so, yes. To buy my new mic. And I think it'd help. Be good. Yeah, just email me at al@abnabandpodcast.co.uk and we'll get a bit of conversation going. But we have got plenty. And the stickers are good, aren't they? I think you've got some. You could join on your laptop. And I've sent a load to Andy. So
it took pride of place on the back of my laptop.
Letter. Had a surprise letter come through the postbox, and I thought, "Who's written a handwritten envelope to me?" I was kind of like getting the, I don't know what the right word is there, but when you're a kid and someone wrote you a letter, like, "Who's wrote me a letter? Oh my god!" And then it's kind of like, "What the hell's this?"
And for the listeners who can't see Andy's face, he looks genuinely chuffed to bits that he received a letter.
It's better than an email, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Get an email and go, oh god. But it was like, ah. So stick it over your Apple logo on your laptop. Stick it over the Apple logo, and stick it over the little penguin logo.
Oi.
And stick it over the Windows logo.
Yeah, so find social media or whatever, and then Telegram group. We've got about 12 people in there. It's got a nice little group in there now. So come along and join us, have a little chat in there. It'll be good. Okay, well, thanks again, John, for coming on. It's been good having your input.
No worries. Glad to be on here again. And if you ever need me back, please don't hesitate to give me a shout.
Yeah, we're sure that won't be a problem. All right, then. Speak to everyone soon.
Bye now.
Cheers, bye-bye.